books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show recorded in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host Robert Kirkwood, and today, different shades of crime. Murder Mystery with Anita Frank and The Good Liars. Some Cozy Crime with Josie Lloyd. And a listen back to the late, great Colin Dexter, creator of Morse. Plus, we'll find some brand new books in the RNIB library. Last on Read On with her book, The Return. It's a welcome return to Anita Frank with her new book, The Good Liars, the Sunday Times best-selling World War I historical fiction murder mystery thriller. The audio version, available both commercially and in the RNIB library, is read by Kirsten Atherton.
She slams the car's door, then watches as it pulls away, its exhaust fumes cutting into the back of her throat as it disappears down the road, leaving her with only her large case and the trepidation churning in her stomach. For a moment, she considers running after it, waving it to a stop, so she can climb back into the relative safety of its confines. But it is too late for that now. So instead, she watches the purple vapour gradually dissipate until, like the car, it is no longer visible, and the whole episode might have been little more than a fragment of her imagination. She lets out the breath she has been holding and bends to pick up the suitcase at her feet. Its weight drags her down, as if it, too, is intent on anchoring her to the spot. This will not do. She lets out another breath, short and sharp this time, and thrusts out her chin with more determination than she feels, firmly telling herself this is the beginning of an adventure. She will see it through, come what may. There is no going back.
Well, The Good Liars is a dark murder mystery set in 1920, and it centres on the once esteemed Stillwell family of Darkacre Hall, who I think it's fair to say are struggling to come to terms with the legacy of the First World War. But their already troubled lives are thrown into further disarray when police decide to reopen the case of a young boy who vanished in the summer of 1914. And suddenly they find themselves facing the scrutiny of Detective Sergeant Verity, who wears a painted copper mask to conceal the facial injuries that he sustained during the war. And if that wasn't unsettling enough, peculiar incidents begin to happen that lead the family to fear the dead may be returning to Darkacre, and as old resentments flare, secrets risk being unearthed that could destroy them all.
Clutching her handbag, her stomach knotted, she mounted the steps and pushed open the door. The murmurous chatter inside stilled immediately. Heat rose in her cheeks as eyes turned upon her. Mouths pinched with displeasure, eyebrows hitched with surprise, foreheads furrowed. On seeing more than one head shake with disgust, she almost turned tail and ran. Then she thought of her boy, her beautiful boy. Wave of anger enveloped her. Her son was as good as theirs, better even. Better than most, certainly. Buoyed with defiance, she walked through them all to take her place in the queue. Heart hammering, she inched forward, waiting her turn. She tried to ignore the whispered comments and pointed stares, but each broke through her fragile defences to land a brutal blow. At last, she found herself facing the Reverend, a ledger spread wide before him, a cash box to his side. Before she could lose her nerve, she opened her bag and placed her hard-earned money upon the table.
"That's my donation."
The Reverend had the good grace to look uncomfortable.
"I'm afraid we cannot accept it." "Why not?" she demanded, a quiver in her voice. "My money's as good as the next man's."
"What seems to be the problem?"
Councillor Jones asked, breaking free from a cluster of onlookers. Her mouth dry, she turned to face him.
I've come to pay my money. My son served his country. His name deserves to be on the memorial, along with the other boys from the village who fought and gave their lives.
Reaching down, he swept the money back towards her.
This memorial is to record the names of the glorious dead, those honourably fallen. Men the community wishes to remember and is proud to do so.
How did you come up with the name for the place, for Dark Acre?
Dark Acre. It wasn't originally called Dark Acre. I think I had very unimaginatively called it Southerton Hall when I first submitted it to my editor. And she said, I love the book, but, you know, it's got to be something catchier than Southerton Hall. And we were throwing around with my agent different ideas. You know, he quite liked the idea of having Fox in the title, so Foxwood House or something like that. And I actually ended up getting an AA map and going through the list of all the towns and villages in the back for inspiration. And I came across Dark Acre and I thought, well, that's perfect, isn't it? Dark Acre Hall. So I suggested that and it was, definitely the one that ticked all the boxes.
Now, you mentioned towns and villages in the back. One thing every town and village will have, or almost all will have, is a war memorial. And the book starts with something that never occurred to me, that some people who died in the war maybe didn't get their names on the local war memorials.
Yeah, and this is one of the things that has always fascinated me about the First World War. So there are lots of things that I've always found particularly interesting about this period of time, from, you know, Kitchener's army and the patriotism that surged through the country, to conscription, to the handing out of white feathers, to the rise of the resurgence of spiritualism, and war memorials, and who got to be on them and who didn't. And this was one of the things that, you know, I wanted to work into the book. So I took all of those aspects that I really loved and I incorporated them all into one story. That's what I wanted to do.
I lost two sons on the Somme, and quite frankly, it would be an insult to their memory and to the memory of all the other brave boys who died so courageously to have the likes of your son listed alongside them. No, unless you wish to make a donation as an act of remorse, I suggest you show some common decency and leave.
My son has a right.
Your son is a disgrace, madam.
The words knocked the wind from her lungs. Her throat ached as tears blurred her vision, but she would not let them fall. She would not give him, give any of them, the satisfaction. Instead, she fostered her rage, fanning its flames with indignation and resentment as she scooped the spurned notes and coins back into her bag. Later, she would be unable to recall the words she shouted as she left the hall, though she would be able to remember every insult thrown after her, every derogatory comment made about her boy. She would not remember how she made it home, but she would remember her knees buckling as she closed the door behind her.
Of a family that doesn't have any war stories, because my grandparents and great-grandparents were either working on ships or working down the mines, but the white feathers were given to people who maybe didn't need to sign up, which is what Ida did, and maybe the rest of the village doesn't like her very much for that.
That's right. I always found this, as I say, a very interesting aspect, that everybody wanted to jump on this bandwagon of patriotism and being seen to be doing their bit. And of course, for frustrated young women, what they could do was hand out these white feathers and make men feel guilty for not being in the army, for not doing their bit. And you do read these accounts of men who were working for the war effort in government and so on, but wouldn't necessarily be in a uniformed position. And it actually started being the case that they would request uniforms, because if they were out in the street in normal civvy suits, that people would come up to them, or women would come up to them and hand them white feathers, not realizing that they were actually hard at work for the war effort in a different capacity. So increasingly, there was this sort of need for everyone to be seen to be wearing a uniform. But these women were indiscriminate in the way that they handed out their white feathers. And of course, there were a lot of people who were in occupations that meant they didn't have to fight. I mean, my own background is obviously I'm a farmer's daughter. And so I don't have a history of soldiers in my family because they were all working the land, feeding the country. That was their contribution to the war effort in the First and the Second World War. But there were others who had medical issues, which meant they weren't fit for service, for active service. And then, of course, you did have people who perhaps didn't look their age. So they were actually too young to be fighting, but they might have looked like they should have been in uniform. So they were also possible targets for these women with their white feathers. So it's just a really interesting area that, you know, and it wounded so deeply that a lot of people, even though they had legitimate reasons for not being in the military, but because they are handed out these white feathers, that sense of guilt and failure is so profound that they find themselves almost trying to cheat the system in order to get to the front and to feel like they're doing the right thing.
Thanks again to Anita Frank. Still to come, we've got Josie Lloyd and Colin Dexter. But first, let's find some brand new books in the RNIB library.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books library. So here are two new gems. Haversham by L. McRae was given to us by HarperCollins.
It is no secret that a great deal of melancholy could have been avoided if Charlotte Haversham had listened to her father. His lessons, delivered as often during their days at the brewery as they were at parties and funerals, were mostly well heeded, except one. No one owes you love. A commandment as vital as any other, but one she had nonetheless ignored until it pierced her, arrow first, through a heart long considered to be made of stone. Perhaps that is why it fractured so easily, why the pieces remain so difficult to gather. It is 3 years since her exile, 3 years since her would-be wedding, and still, Charlotte wears the dress. Not every day, not anymore, but she has fastened herself into the silk coffin often enough that the pearl buttons at the sleeve have fallen away, and the fabric is yellowing at the hem. Her lace veil, however, is fashioned to the top of a mop's head. It has been so long since she has heard her wedding march.
Jilted bride, mad witch, tragic villainess, this time she will have her revenge. Charlotte Haversham has a secret. She's been underestimated for too long by her former fiancé, by her family, and by society. But now her true heart's desire is within reach for the first time, and she will stop at nothing to get it. This is the story of Miss Haversham if you have never heard it before, and she will exceed all expectations. A thrilling and immersive historical novel, Haversham is a queer feminist reimagining in which Dickens' most infamous female character tells her side of the story at last.
Seated at the pianoforte, Charlotte's fingers glide easily over the keys, foot thumping against the pedal as the music swells through her morning room. She should stop. Should get dressed properly. Eat breakfast, take the air. Complete the rituals that used to anchor her days before. Before him. But she plays on. And the groom collapses 2 bars before the coda. Naturally, he is not a living groom. Only a broom, its handle trussed up in a bow tie and propped against the instrument. Whether it was the thump of her foot, the vibrations of the melody, or divine intervention that caused it, Charlotte is uncertain. But he falls, and his bride follows suit, swooning dramatically to the floor like a keening lover.
Haversham by L. McRae is read by Albie Baldwin and runs for 12 hours 33 minutes.
The Midnight Train by Matt Haig was given to us by Canongate.
Maggie? Oh, Lord. Maggie, is that you? He stumbled slightly and lowered himself into the nearest chair. Across the room, a wedding photograph perched above the fireplace, tucked amid trophies for British Business Person of the Year, Wilbur and Maggie walking out of the church.
Yes, it's me.
How did you get the number? Instantly he cursed himself for asking. It sounded so defensive. He wanted nothing more than for her to have his number and to call him. But it had come out all wrong.
You gave me it, remember? You sent me a message on Facebook 6 years ago.
Oh, yes, I did. I thought you never saw that message.
I saw it. I don't do Facebook, but I saw it. I just didn't know what to say.
Wilbur was feeling the pressure in his shoulder again. He stared at the wedding photograph through the distorted perspex of one of his trophies. Maggie's laughter and Wilbur's uncomplicated smile. On paper, their marriage lasted for 20 years. Though, if he was honest, it died way earlier. But back then, it was going to be forever.
When your life flashes before your eyes, what will matter most? For Wilbur, it was his time with Maggie, the love of his life. Their honeymoon in Venice, before he threw it all away. Years later, on the brink of his own death, a train arrives. It can take Wilbur back in time to relive his most important moments. Soon he realises just how much he would have changed. An adventure through time, The Midnight Train is a story of love and second chances from the world of the Midnight Library.
Where are you?
I'm in Sheffield. What about you? Bedfordshire, right?
Yes, Clop Hill. It's a lovely little village. He nearly added, but it is lonely. Maggie, it is good to hear from you.
It was strange. After all these years, he didn't know how to talk to her. It was as though the passing of time brought its own formality.
How someone you once slept beside every night could become a stranger through years of silence. As though, except for brief interludes, the natural setting of humanity was to be impossibly distant from each other. He tried again.
I have things I've been wanting to say, to ask you, to make amends for.
Don't be silly, Wilbur. It's all water under the bridge.
It's so funny you should say that. I've started playing the piano.
He looked down at his time-weathered hands, the veins like a map to an unknown town.
I have lessons every Saturday, and I've just been playing Bridge Over Troubled Water and remembering how you loved it. It did rather take me back.
The good old days.
Yes, the good old days.
Wilbur.
Wilbur.
That second Wilbur had a firmness to it. He realised he was just prattling on without asking about her.
I'm sorry, Maggie. How are you? It's been so long. I saw on the internet that you had an exhibition for your art in...
Oh, that was years ago, she said, almost shy. I hardly do it anymore. He worried she was about to tell him she was dying. That did seem to be the prime reason people from his past contacted him, to tell him they were about to die, or that someone else he knew was.
It's really silly.
What silly?
This phone call.
It's nice to hear from you.
Well, I have no reason at all to phone you. In fact, I always told myself I never would.
Oh, right. Yes.
Not out of spite or anything, just it's a little bit sad, isn't it? But then recently I thought it would be... Well, I wanted to hear your voice, which sounds ridiculous.
No, not at all. and then he smiled. My voice is pretty special. Her small laugh ended with a sad inflection. Well, you still have some of your accent, just... just.
The Midnight Train by Matt Haig is read by James Norton and runs for 8 hours 36 minutes.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
We're having a crime-filled episode of Read On today. We've had Murder Mystery, we'll have Inspector Morse later, but now, let's get some cosy crime with Josie Lloyd. Josie Lloyd has been writing for 26 years, and was last on Read On talking about life-saving for beginners, and before that, the Cancer Ladies Running Club. Her first 7 books were written with her writing partner and then husband, Emlyn Rees, and stay tuned for an exclusive about that writing partnership coming up later on in today's show. But the book we're going to primarily talk about came out yesterday, if you're listening to this on the day it was released. Miss Beaton's Murder Agency is a gripping new cosy crime mystery. And as you'll hear during the interview, when I talked to Josie, the audio version hadn't been recorded yet. But hopefully future me is going to put in a clip as narrated by Emily Pennant May.
Alice Beaton shut the hardback library book with a satisfied snap. Never trust a man with a dimple in his chin. The kettle trilled like an old-fashioned police whistle. Alice walked across the small kitchen to turn off the gas, releasing the cap so that it gasped, the boiling water inside fizzing. Agatha barked once in reply, her bright brown eyes staring up at Alice, who now took a china cup and 2 saucers from the cupboard, moving the remaining crockery a fraction to retain their pleasingly neat stacks. With a silver spoon, she measured out the precise amount of Earl Grey tea leaves from the caddy into the teapot before filling it up from the kettle and placing a knitted cosy on top. As a self-confessed addict of crime fiction, Alice loved the twisty plots, red herrings and scattered clues that invariably resulted in her outsmarting most fictional detectives, with the exception of Miss Marple, of course. She had a prized set of all 80 Agatha Christies, after whom she'd named her dog, but she'd run out of space for any more books.
You've been on the show twice, first with Red Sail and the Cancer Ladies Running Club, then with me and Life Saving for Beginners, and I believe that chat with Red inspired a scene in Life Saving for Beginners.
It certainly did, because he was a great swimmer, well, still is a great swimmer, and goes to the Hampstead Pond, and I was talking to him about it. I mean... I do have a sign in my kitchen, Robert, that says, careful or you'll end up in my novel, which actually does actually happen. So I was talking to Red and I was like, I'm putting you in a scene. So I actually put in at the end scene where one of my characters meets this guy at the Hampstead Pond. It was all inspired by Red and him swimming there. So, yeah, it was really great. And he was really helpful, actually, with the details of it and what it felt like to kind of go in the water there.
Have you been in the sea this morning?
I certainly have. In fact, I'm glad this is not a visual thing because... I'm really pink. I've just been to the sauna. We have a sauna down on the seafront in Brighton. And I went with a gang of people this morning for a sauna. And then we swam in the sea in the rain. And it was absolutely glorious. I mean, it's belting it down here in Brighton currently. But it was beautiful swimming in the sea in the rain. And all the pier was really misty. And it was lovely. So, yes, I have just been in the sea.
Now, you're swapping the Brighton beaches for A rather shabby block in Kensington. Tell us about Miss Beaton's murder agency.
Well, crime, as we know, is a broad church, Robert, and I would describe this as the cake stand in the hall. I mean, it is cosy crime, but I've always been intrigued by Mrs. Beaton, she of the very famous Book of Household Management, which came out in the Victorian era. And my granny had a copy of it, and it's so thick that I used to stand on it as a step when I was a tiny child. And then when I was clearing out my parents' house recently, I found the big copy of Mrs. Beaton's book. And I kind of thought, well, it'd be really fun to use this heritage. Also, because I really love recipes in books, because ever since I read Nora Ephron's Heartburn, I love the idea of having recipes in books. So this is the kind of what went into it. Anyway, I came up with Miss Beaton's Murder Agency, featuring Alice Beaton, who is a fictionally distant relative of the very famous Mrs. Beaton. And she runs the Good Household Management Agency in London. And she places elite staff for the uber rich. So she places nannies and chauffeurs and butlers and all these kind of things. She runs it with her best friend, Jinx, who is a lapsed it girl from the 90s with a wardrobe full of clothes and, you know, knows everybody. And this wonderful new girl, Enya, comes in. She's a new hire. And at the same time, Miss Beaton receives a call from Camille Messon, who's very posh and French, and says that her housekeeper has suddenly left. She's in a bind. Could Miss Beaton send someone? And it seems serendipitous and wonderful. And off she sends Enya to work in the Messons. And off she goes for Christmas. But then on New Year's Eve, she gets the call that Enya has been found murdered in the study of the Messons' household at their New Year's Eve party. And now Miss Beaton has to go in and find out why.
Alice's basement flat was never at its best early in the day, only brightening up when the sun was above the buildings opposite. Pulling up the Roman blind above the sink and peering up through the barred windows to street level, she noticed the weak, grey shimmer of the December sky. But the beast from the east that was predicted had yet to arrive. It really didn't look like it was going to snow, but you could never be too sure. Nevertheless, it was definitely a day for a thermal vest. On the table, trumpets of orange amaryllis that one of her grateful clients had sent filled the kitchen with a cheery dash of exotic colour. But despite everything being just right in her flat, it was hard to ignore the loud neighbours upstairs. She winced as that dratted son of theirs bounced a ball across her ceiling. She flicked on the radio, which was set permanently to classic FM, and turned up the blast of Vivaldi as a riposte. Agatha barked again and tipped her head to one side. "I'm doing it," Alice said. "Be patient."
It was a really fun concept to write the book. So I've used Miss Beaton. She's quite a kind of quirky character, but I grew up on all those kind of women like Murder, She Wrote, Miss Marple, all this kind of thing. And I really hankered to write a midlife crime woman who's not forensic. She's got nothing to do with crime, but she's just got a bit of an ordered mind. And I kind of thought that was my way in to make her somebody much more akin to me than somebody like a detective or something like that.
And it's it's got a contemporary setting, but it feels quite retro as well.
Yeah, I wanted to go for that kind of, you know, that lovely feeling of like films like Paddington or that kind of thing where you have it's contemporary, but it's got all the best of London. And I love London. And when I was a very small child, we used to go to London to see my grandmother who lived there. And we lived in Essex. That's where I grew up. And we used to drive to London. And it was very exciting because we would drive through the streets of the kind of East End of London. And you would see St. Paul's and the Tower of London and all of the big sites. And I was always enamoured with London. And my grandmother used to take me to see, to find Wombles on Wimbledon Common. That was when I was really tiny. But I used to write diaries on the way to see her, and she was the one that used to read them and laugh, not for the right reasons, I might add. I always kind of thought, well, I can entertain somebody through writing, and that was why I always wanted to become a writer. But I really wanted to use London in the best bits of London, the nice bits of London, and put all those kind of iconic buildings in that I love so much, but to have somebody sort of living and breathing it and being there. So it, yes, it is contemporary and it is set now, but I don't really, it's not kind of reliant on loads of technology, and it's got a cast of characters that kind of are fairly timeless. And yeah, she's got quite a retro vibe. And of course, it's all interdispersed with these original recipes from Mrs. Beaton's book. So, you know, recipes for her Christmas cake and the Christmas bunch. But I've also put recipes in that I love that are kind of cozy recipes for winter. So things like tiffin and, you know, nice soups and things like that. So it's quite fun.
It has got quite a wintry feel to the book. Can you describe the cover for us?
Yes, it's beautiful, the cover, actually. It's got a house, it's red, it's snowing, and it's a house, and it's a bit like, it's kind of got a murdery vibe. You can see there's a thief or a robber in shadow in one of the top windows, and then somebody, Miss Beaton, is in another top window of the house kind of looking. And by the front door is Agatha, and Agatha really is the star of the book. She is a Jack Russell Corgi cross, a Kojak, I've named her, and she was found by Alice near the bins by Buckingham Palace. So she kind of has always entertained the thought that Agatha was related to the royal corgis. And of course, she is named after Agatha Christie, as Miss Beaton has all of the Agatha Christies. She has all 90 of them in her house, and they're her prized possessions because she loves reading, and she loves reading crime books and working things out. So Agatha is named after Agatha Christie, and she is the star of the show. And on the cover of the book, Agatha is there with a rubber glove in her mouth going into the house. So it's very Christmassy, and it's very London, and, you know, it's got a nice cozy feel to it. I mean, it's got, obviously, it's crime, it's got dark elements in it, and there's quite a lot of jeopardy in it, but it's got this lovely vibe to it.
No spoilers, but is there a trigger warning for dog lovers?
No, don't worry. Well, yeah, to be fair, there is some jeopardy involving Agatha, but I can't give the plot away. She's quite a star in it, though. And it's quite interesting, the marketing that's now sort of starting to happen because the book's about to come out. And the marketing team at the publishers have fallen in love with Agatha and have made her kind of completely integral to the kind of point of sale and everything that's going on in the shop. So it's really fun.
Now, this is one of these interviews that we are recording it long before it will be broadcast. The sun's shining, the trees are still green. By the time you listen to this, it will be well into autumn. So you have just cast the audio version. Even though we heard a clip of it at the start of this interview, at the time of recording, we've just cast Emily Pennant-Ree. How did you end up with that narrator?
Well, there were several that were offered. And it's the weirdest thing as an author to be presented with the voices of actors, because you are sent clips of other things that they've done on Audible or on in any kind of audio world. And a lot of the really fantastic audio artists that we have working are so versatile. They've done everything. They've done kind of nonfiction, they've done fiction and crime and all sorts of things, and comedy. And so you get a kind of real kind of smorgasbord of what a voice can do. And then you're trying to pin it onto your character. And of course, when you write your own book, your characters have their own voices in your head. And it's so weird then hearing somebody else's voice, because you're like, oh, is that voice hers or not? And so it's a tricky one. And it's a kind of inexact science. You can't really tell, because at that point when you're casting, they're not actually reading your words. They're not giving you a sample of your book. You're listening to a sample of somebody else's book. And then, so it's just really about the tone of somebody's voice. And I felt that she had the right tone, because Alice is quite prim and proper. And like the kind of great Mrs. Beaton, Miss Beaton, Alice, is kind of prim and proper and believes that if a job's worth doing, it's worth doing well. And she's kind of quite fastidious, and she's set in her ways, and she's single, she's in her mid-50s, and she kind of likes things done properly. And she doesn't like people being rude, and she likes decorum and manners, and she's a stickler for things. So she has that kind of personality, although she does have quite a soft side as well. So it's about getting that tone. But of course, you don't want somebody really, I didn't want somebody really posh or really fuddy-duddy, because it has to be relatable. So I, as an author, I find it incredibly difficult. But I listened to Emily's voice and I thought, yeah, actually, she'll be great for the job. So she's doing it. So hopefully, by the time your listeners will be listening to this, it will be out, and they will be able to listen in to me at the end, because I'm going to go in and do an interview with her at the end of the recording, which will be very exciting. Because I love that, when you get authors actually talking at the end of the recording. I've just listened to Elif Shafak's beautiful recording of There Are Rivers in the Sky. And it was lovely hearing her at the end doing her author's note.
You're quite a fan of Elif Shafak. I remember you picked the Island of Missing Trees as one of your recommendations.
That's funny because, that was probably the last. I am a fan of lots of other people, but yeah, I just happened to listen to that one.
Now it's in audio, though. It's accessible to people for whatever reason don't have a relationship with print. Is that important to you?
Yes. And I actually think that it's very important as well now that writers are, I think, years ago, audio, we always used to record for the libraries, my books that I did with Emlyn, and we were always sort of very excited. But I'm so pleased that the audio world has completely taken off now and is bringing so many more readers to fiction because they're able to listen and get really involved and absorbed in it. And I think it's making authors write in a different way, because you're aware when you're writing that this is going to be spoken. And actually, I've just finished another book that I'm writing with Emlyn, my husband, because we used to write together, and we've just written another book together, and we kind of had to read it out. And it's funny because when you write it, you're writing it as a prose, but then when you read it, you realize, oh, well, hang on, that needs to be three sentences, not one. You know, you start to realize that you have to be a bit more amenable to how it's going to sound rather than how it's just going to read. So there's minute differences, but they do make quite a difference.
I think I mentioned this to you before, but for new listeners, I recorded half of Come Together. I think I recorded the male half of it.
Brilliant, did you?
For the RNIB version, it's read by David
Thorpe. Fabulous.
But it was one of these cases where I had to dig out a copy of the book and read the female version so I knew what was happening. Yeah. Thanks again to Josie Lloyd. That book she mentioned that she wrote with her husband Emlyn Rees is called You and Me, You and Me, You and Me. It's available in audio as read by Rory Kinnear and Sally Phillips. It's also available in the RNIB library, where it joins these two new books.
Rabbit Hole by Mark Billingham was given to us by Little Brown.
I was on my way to scrounge some tobacco from Lucy, who I sometimes called Elplay, and is probably the poshest person I've ever met, who doesn't like anyone touching her and thinks the world is flat, when I heard it all kicking off in the little room next to the canteen. The room with the yellow wallpaper and the settee. The music room, because there's some dusty bongos on a shelf and a guitar with four strings. I could still smell that watery curry Eileen had done for lunch. I'd eat it all, don't get me wrong, two plates full, because I've always had a big appetite, and you eat what's put in front of you, but the whiff of it an hour or so afterwards was making me feel slightly sick. Yeah, I remember that. Mind you, lots of things make me feel a bit green around the gills these days, and it's not like this place ever smells particularly lovely, let's be honest.
They were meant to be safe on Fleet Ward. Psychiatric patients monitored, treated and cared for. But now one of their number is found murdered and the accusations begin to fly. Was it one of his fellow patients, a member of staff, or did someone come in from the outside? DC Alice Armitage is methodical, tireless and she's quickly on the trail of the killer. The only problem is, Alice is a patient too.
So, I was bowling down the corridor, trying not to think about the smell and gasping for a fag, when I heard all the shouting, swearing and screaming, stuff being chucked about, all that. This was a Wednesday afternoon, 2 days before they found the body. The sound really echoes in here, so I didn't think too much about it to begin with. It's not like I haven't seen people lose it before, so I thought it might just be a row that sounded a lot worse than it was, and it wasn't until I actually got to the doorway and saw how full-on things were that I knew I was going to have to do something about it, that I needed to step in. I'm an idiot. 3 days before they found the body. Three. It was a proper scrum in there. A couple of people were watching. One bloke I don't know very well was actually clapping, like he thought it was some kind of special entertainment that had been laid on. but everyone else was grabbing and grunting, lurching around the room and knocking furniture over. Watching from the doorway, I couldn't really tell who was doing the fighting and who was trying to stop the people who were doing the fighting. It was too late to work out what had started it, but I guessed it didn't really matter by then and probably never mattered much to begin with. It doesn't take much round here. Half a dozen of them tangled up, scratching or pulling and calling each other all sorts. A melee. That's the word, right? French, for a bunch of bad-tempered twats making idiots of themselves. Wrestling and cursing, spitting threats. The waiter, he was there, and the Somali woman who likes touching people's feet, was getting properly stuck in, which was amazing, as she's about 5 foot nothing and skinny as a stick. Ilias was throwing his considerable weight about, as was Lauren, while Donna and Big Gay Bob wriggled and squealed. And the thing was there, obviously. He was right in the thick of it, kicking a chair over, then trying to swing a punch at Kevin, who was backed up against a wall, while somebody else, whose face I couldn't see beneath the hoodie, was hanging onto the thing's arm for dear life. I mean, Christ on a bike. I wasn't remotely surprised that none of the people who get paid to sort out stuff like this were in much of a hurry. They'd seen it all before, that's the truth.
Rabbit's Hole by Mark Billingham is read by Maxine Peake and runs for 9 hours and 53 minutes.
Nominated for the 2026 International Booker Award, The Director by Daniel Kelman was given to us by River Run from the Hachette Group.
Why am I in this car? I'll sit still. Sometimes, if you don't move, your memory comes back. But it's not working. One thing is certain. The driver is smoking. The vehicle is filled with heavy smoke. My eyes are burning. I feel sick. The man has grey hair, dandruff on his shoulders. On the rearview mirror, a small cross is swinging on a string of pearls. One thing at a time. The driver picked me up, held the door open for me, and the others looked on open-mouthed. Scrawny Franz Kraler, stupid Frau Einzinger, and also the small man whose name I can never remember. Because actually, at the Abendruh Sanatorium, every day is the same as the next. At breakfast, the radio is on. You go to the park. Your back hurts. There's lunch. You look at the newspaper and get annoyed while the TV is on. Some are watching. Others are sleeping. Someone is always coughing pitifully. Then it's already 3:30 and dinner is served. And then you lie awake and have to go to the bathroom every half an hour. Sometimes there are visitors, but never for me. Sometimes someone dies and is taken away. But those who are still alive are not usually picked up by a black car with a chauffeur.
G.W. Pabst was one of cinema's greatest, perhaps the greatest director of his era. When the Nazis seized power, he was filming in France, and to escape the horrors of the new Germany, he flees to Hollywood. But under the blinding California sun, the world-famous director suddenly looks like a nobody. Not even Greta Garbo, who he made famous, can help him. And thus, almost through no fault of his own, he finds himself back in his homeland of Austria. The returning family is confronted with the barbaric nature of the regime. But Goebbels, the Minister of Propaganda in Berlin, wants the film genius. He won't take no for an answer and makes big promises. While Pabst still believes that he will be able to resist these advances, that he will not submit to any dictatorship other than art, he has already taken the first steps into a hopeless entanglement. Daniel Kelman's novel about art and power, beauty and barbarism, is a triumph.
We stop at an intersection, where three teenagers with long hair are crossing the street very slowly. The driver rolls down the window and yells that another war would do young punks like them some good, and when they ignore him, he only gets angrier. He drives off, still ranting. And now it comes back to me, to the television studio. "But which programme?" I ask, leaning forward. The driver turns around and looks at me through the clouds of smoke, not understanding. I repeat the question.
I don't care, he shouts. Why should I give a damn?
So I don't say anything else. But he's getting worked up.
I want to be left alone, just left alone. Is that too much to ask?
When we stop in front of the broadcasting studio, he's just pulled himself together. He gets out, walks around the car, opens the door for me. He grabs me by the elbow, pulls me up. This is rude, but it actually helps me get on the street without falling. The facade of the broadcasting studio is even greyer than the surrounding facades. All the buildings in Vienna are grey now, except for a few that are dark brown. The whole city seems covered with dirt. In winter, the sky is stony and low. In summer, yellowishly damp. Even that was different once.
The Director, by Daniel Kelman, is narrated by Nicholas Bolton and runs for 11 hours 31 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
Love books? Well, RNIB Library has a world of books and loads more reading for you to enjoy. And you can choose from Braille and talking books. For more info, head to rniblibrary.com or call our expert team on 0303 123 9999. RNIB Library, here for all your reading needs.
And finally, on this crime-ridden episode of Read On, let's listen back to one of the masters of the genre, the late, great Colin Dexter.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
Inspector Morse is frequently mentioned in the same breath as Sherlock Holmes or Hercule Poirot as one of the great detectives. He first appeared in the Colin Dexter book, Last Bus to Woodstock.
The evening's merriness wilted like a sad balloon, and voices gradually hushed as the whispered rumour spread. There had been a murder. None seemed anxious to leave. Two or three asked if they could phone. All felt suddenly sober, including a pale-faced young man who stood in the manager's office and whose scarcely-touched whiskey still stood on the counter of the cocktail lounge. With the arrival of Sergeant Lewis and two uniformed constables, a small knot of people gathered curiously on the pavement outside. It did not escape their notice that the police car had parked immediately across the access to the courtyard, effectively sealing the exit. 5 minutes later, a second police car arrived, and eyes turned to the lightly built, dark-haired man who alighted. He conversed briefly with the constable, who stood guard outside, nodded his head approvingly several times, and walked into the Black Prince. He knew Sergeant Lewis only slightly, but soon found himself pleasurably impressed by the man's level-headed competence.
Robert Gladwell reading Last Bus to Woodstock by Colin Dexter. And although not mentioned by name, that lightly built, dark-haired man's entrance heralded the first appearance of Inspector Endeavour Morse, although it'd be a few years before we found out that first name. Author Colin Dexter joined me on the line from his and Morse's native Oxford, and we chatted about his influences and how to write a great crime novel.
The only thing that I ever did, which applied to everything I wrote, not just crime books, was the fact that I used to know the end before the beginning. In the criminological world, as you probably know, you hear those people who think that everything springs from character, and this is what's the key thing in a crime story. I never understood that at all. Because I was very glad to have one idea, and that was the finish. And people say to me, you know, did you know the end before the beginning? And I just have to be honest and say, you know, if I didn't know the end, I'd never know the beginning. I wouldn't know where to go. So I think the biggest influence in my life, which is not all that great really, would be my parents wanted it at all. They were both of them left school at the age of 12, so they had no, as it were, secondary knowledge of what we would think as the normal classics in English literature. And I remember we had three books only in the house when I was a lad, and they were Medicine Today, which was a big, thick book, and I think it was published in 1886. And, you know, it didn't really give any up-to-date medicines to take or anything. That was one book, which was often consulted. And secondly, we had Sacred Songs and Solos, which we all had to study and learn the words. Not that we were a religious family, but I think father and mother were in choirs. One of them was in the choir conducted by Malcolm Sargent. So he knew all about hymns. If we did read any books, we used to Smith's Lending Library when I was a young lad. I've often blessed ever since people who founded the local libraries.
Now, most of the Morse audiobooks are narrated by actors involved in the TV series, but there are a few rarer ones that were narrated by yourself.
I didn't have much to do with audiobooks, except I was asked to do it, and I did three, I think, of my own books. I think I got the sack after three books. They said, you know, you did write this, didn't you? You're not reading it as if you know, you understand what's going to happen next. Well, there's some truth in that, except that I always knew how it was going to end. And I very often get asked that question. You know the great controversy about characterization, you know, fires the whole thing. And the plot is secondary. I've always felt exactly the opposite to that. I've always felt the hardest thing in life is to get some twist, because the person who influenced me more than anybody else was Agatha Christie. I never met Agatha Christie, but she was the great guru in those days, and I've admired her enormously. Of all the crime writers I've known, all of them, she had more imagination than almost all of us put together. A wonderfully fertile mind for plot. But a wonderful woman, but I believe that they say I never met her. But they said she was very shy, and although she was the chairman for several years of the Detection Club, I don't think she was ever a public persona. And somebody like P.D. James, who's absolutely marvellous with the public. 92 years old now and speaks as if she's a spring chicken. I think she's a remarkable woman, and we're very good friends. But I don't find it at all easy to read books at the moment. But my eyes are not getting worse, so I'm happy from that point of view.
Now, off air, we were chatting about your eyesight and a past problem with AMD, and I'm going to get you to repeat what you said about getting or going for an eye examination.
You know, everybody getting older these days, including you, my dear friend. If you don't go, as my girl who looks after me at the John Ratcliffe Hospital in Auckland here, it's no good saying it was 3 years ago. And if you say, well, 1 year, then it will make it up as you go along. And she said to me, you ought to go every 6 months. But I think it's an enormous importance for everybody to go very regularly. And in the next 10 years, I think there'll be a revolution in so many treatments by medicines. And I've been lucky enough to have this macular degeneration. I suppose you know a few people with macular degeneration.
Yes, oh yeah. Just to clarify, you weren't lucky to have AMD, you were lucky to have it successfully treated.
Yes, it was. Yes, Americans, the women hated it because they couldn't bear the thought of having somebody having to pierce their eyes with a needle. But on the other hand, of course, the whole business of our needles, I've been diabetic since 66, and it is quite remarkable, really, that the biggest single revolution in medicine is that the needles, now instead of being short and fat and stubby and painful, you hardly feel them going in at the moment. I'm on another long course of insulin at the moment. I've been, well, there since 66. But it is amazing that you can, you don't feel it these days.
RNIB have a campaign running called Spot the Signs. How did you spot the signs of your sight loss?
I've always been a big crossword addict, and I decided at one stage that the little numbers in the top right-hand corner, the goalpost corner of the square, individual number 8 across or something like that, that I was misleading myself all the time, like A's and 3's and that lowercase r and the, well, the uppercase anything sometimes. But I began to say, think, oh, of course I can't do it. I can't read the clue properly. And so at the moment I don't do crosswords. It's infuriating if you can't read what's on the page.
We definitely need to have some giant print crosswords sent to you from RNIB. There are many, many Colin Dexter books available in the Talking Books Library. For more information on how to join the RNIB Talking Books Library, head to rnib.org.uk/library. Just search for RNIB Library or call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999. That's all we've got time for on today's show. We'll be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, this and over 450 other episodes of Read On are available to download as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On in your favourite podcast app. But remember our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB Library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.